Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. On every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home in the Hamptons to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Join Ina as she crafts a classic cocktail with journalist Frank Bruni and discusses the ins and outs of Yorkshire pudding with actress Emily Mortimer. If you're looking for great conversations about and over good food, tune in to Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts. Hey, it's Francis. And, you know, after we got to take our show on the road to Hawaii last year, we came home with a new friend, Chef Robin Mai'i from Honolulu. So right away, we called her back up and had her join us for an episode where she took your cooking questions. And where our old friend Nick Sharma showed up to talk about crispy things. Check it out. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. So our episode today is dedicated to your cooking questions. We love to hear from you anytime, so keep your questions coming. And one of the reasons I love these call-in shows is that I get to do them with friends helping me out. Today, we have the chef Robin Mai'i. She's probably one of the most down-to-earth cooks to ever won a James Beard Award. You know, the menu at her restaurant Fett in Honolulu, it's not precious tastings or tweezer food. It's a steak that tastes like Korean barbecue and club sandwiches and fried chicken. Anyway, when I got to meet her a few months back, she actually told me how much she's loved listening to our show over the years and how she really loves it when listeners call in. So we asked her if she wanted to come on over. And here is Robin Mai'i. So Chef Robin, great to see you.
Hi, Francis. Thank you for having me.
I am so excited to have you, and I wish I was there with you right now in your beautiful restaurant in Honolulu. But I am in a weird office in Midtown Manhattan, so it feels very far away.
Well, don't worry. The weather isn't perfect today, so you're not missing much.
Thank you for telling me. That is the kindest thing you could have told me.
Okay.
Okay, so actually, let's go back to when we first met there in Hawaii. And when we were talking, you were telling me the story of like your very winding path to become a chef. You were a dancer, among other things. But obviously, being from Hawaii, you've been exposed to the food of so many different cultures your whole life. Was there like a specific experience you had in the restaurant industry that made you think, yes, I love this. I want to cook. I want to serve people.
I think I had that experience before I even knew what the restaurant industry was. It was in college. I decided that I wanted to go to culinary school. And I think it was obviously because of my love of food and growing up in a cooking family, not professional, but just a family that loved to cook. Mm-hmm. But also, I just kept the same question in my head. What can I see myself doing day in and day out, for hours and then for years? And I just couldn't see myself sitting at a desk. I didn't necessarily think that I could dance for 30 years. And so cooking just really called to me.
Mm. And then when you're cooking, like, what's the feeling you have? I mean, obviously, it's like, it's a very different thing when you're cooking in a restaurant. But like, when you're actually physically doing the act of cooking, like, do you still have a connection to that feeling?
Yeah, it's every day. So when people say, so what does having a modern dance degree have to do with cooking? And every single day, I feel like I'm dancing. Because And I think if you talk to people who do live theater or musicians or dancers, they'll all say the same thing where after the set, they'll say, oh, that felt awesome. Or, okay, maybe that was a little bit awkward. And the reality is that really nobody, the guests or the audience doesn't really know. They just hopefully enjoy the presentation or the music or the live performance. But it is that sort of uncertainty of what everyone else is doing, and you hope that it just lines up and that everyone's in the right place. And sometimes people are not in the right place, and what do you do in that moment? And cooking is exactly the same. It's so dynamic every single day. And so I do feel like I'm very close to the dancing part. And then I also get to cook. So that it's I don't know. It just all makes sense to me.
Yeah. You know, when I look at your restaurant's menu, it gets so eclectic, right? There's like steak that looks like sort of Korean barbecue. There's fried chicken and collard greens. There's cannoli for dessert, maybe with passion fruit because you are in Hawaii. You know, there's a very unpretentious feeling to the menu. There's just like a kind of vibe to when I'm reading it. There's a vibe just like, this is just delicious food. Like it's not like I'm not trying to like have a concept or have this like big picture thing we're trying to do here. Like it just feels like, oh, I love this dish. I want to make this for you. I love this dish. I want you to enjoy that. Is your cooking at home like similar to your restaurant cooking?
Yes, it's exactly how we grew up eating food in my house. My parents are both third generation. So I always tell everyone I feel like a fake Korean because even though my mother is ethnically pure Korean, she can't speak a lick of it. And we grew up eating, yes, Korean food on special occasions, but mostly American food, spaghetti, taco night. She would make these spare ribs with sauerkraut, of course, chili, fried chicken, enchiladas. So she felt she was a magazine reader. She subscribed to Bon Appetit and to Gourmet magazine. And so she was always flipping through and trying to keep things kind of like fresh for her family of five. And so we grew up eating exactly how the restaurant menu reads.
Oh, that's so funny. It's so funny because it totally feels like, oh, I can totally imagine a magazine where like, oh, one spread is going to be like, oh, here's great sandwiches. And the next spread is.
Yes.
And, oh, here's a cool way to do your collard greens.
And it was my mother is a teacher professionally. So she really loved following the recipe. She is we call her a recipe hugger. Yeah. My dad is your typical sort of like male cook, meaning that they feel more free spirited and like don't follow the recipe, making the waffles, right? Making the pancakes on Sunday, but also like manning the grill outside. So they really fell into kind of conventional, gender roles in the kitchen. But I think the mix really, I just took it for granted that everyone grew up eating delicious food like us. And then I realized how, you know, when you approach adulthood, how special it was. And so I don't take it for granted anymore.
Yeah, right on. And so when you have like a day off or whatever, and you're going out, where do you go eat? Like, what do you love to go eat?
I like to eat at the Hole in the Walls. Mm-hmm. So the places that do specific dishes really, really well, because it reminds me of terrific home cooking.
Yeah. What's an example? Like, where'd you go last weekend?
I love Helena's Hawaiian food. And I know that that's a very, you know, it's iconic. It's a classic restaurant, but the food has been the same for decades. And it's just when you take a bite, it just soothes you in all the right ways. It's nostalgic and it's not in your head. It tastes exactly the same. And so, you know how sometimes you go to restaurants and then everyone at the table is like, oh, it's not the same. It's different. No, Helena's is the same.
Every time.
Every time. There's another restaurant that I like, a Vietnamese restaurant that I like to go to. Oh my goodness. What is the name of the restaurant? Oh, Bac Nam. That's the name of the restaurant. It's on King Street. And it's the same thing. It's literally run by a husband and wife team. And they've owned it for decades now too. And the wife is in the kitchen every day. Every day. She's in the kitchen.
Yeah, these people. It's like the iconic holes in the wall. Like, you love them, you lionize them, but a little bit you want to be like, God, take a break.
And you know, like, I'm not going
close
to
one day a week for yourself.
I do have to mention that, and I feel very comfortable sharing this with you, but I do eat an inordinate amount of Zippy's takeout.
Right on.
because
it is the Hawaiian diner.
It is the Hawaiian diner, and it's super, super consistent, and it never disappoints.
Right on. Actually, let me, since you talked about Helena's, I want to ask you one quick thing about that. What's your order at Helena's? So Helena's is like this, everyone I talk to in Hawaii who was like, oh, did you have like straight up like Hawaiian food, like native Hawaiian food? And I said, oh, well, where should I go? And they all say, go to Helena's. So what's your order there?
Our order is we have the pork lau lau. Mm. We have their, they call it pipi kaula. And pipi kaula means different things to, within Hawaii, but their pipi kaula is basically marinated short ribs that get slow cooked. And the recipe is very, very, very secret. Mm. You cannot get that recipe out of the fine folks that work at Helena's. So if I had to try to recreate it, there is soy sauce. There is sugar, there is garlic, perhaps there is a kiss of ginger, but not much else.
Yeah. And what's the pork lau lau like?
The pork lau lau is, it's pork butt that's been slow cooked within the luau leaves. And the leaves just become slick with that fat from the pork butt, and it becomes very melty, even meltier than collards.
And
really, there's no other green that I can compare it to. It literally melts in your mouth. We have that with poi, lomi salmon. I always have to get rice. And I love their squid luau, which is same leaves, the luau leaf, but lots of coconut milk. And we in Hawaii, we say squid, but it's not actually, we really mean octopus. So we call it squid luau, but it's actually octopus.
Okay. And the luau leaf is it's taro leaves, right? It's like the greens from the taro plant.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. They really are amazing. Like when they cook down, they are so silky and melty. Like
yes.
Like imagine like the most tender spinach you've ever had.
Yes. But it doesn't have, you know how when you eat spinach I know there's something chemically going on on the palate, but it has that sort of astringent.
Mm-hmm. It makes your teeth kind of like
a chalky
rough.
And rough.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
That
doesn't
happen with the luau leaf. It's a very, 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 it's unctuous.
It's smooth and it's such a great texture.
Yes.
I love it. All right. Well, now I'm really missing Hawaii. We're talking to Chef Robin Mai, and we'll be back with her to take your questions in a moment. I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. In every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking an amazing meal. Listen as Ina does what she does best, make good conversation and delicious food, while making it sound fun and easy. This season, Ina dives into conversation with astronaut and colonel Nicole Mann. As Ina teaches Nicole how to make seared scallops with celery root puree, they talk about everything from family to what foods Nicole really craves when she's in space. And listen in as Ina and Pulitzer Prize-winning writer David Remnick talk about music lessons and the value of developing language skills before joining their spouses for a lively conversation over a comforting dish of chicken parmesan. If you love a good chat over a great meal, you'll love Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts. Our show is supported by Hero Bread. You know, for a lot of us, bread has been a staple all our lives. Toast at breakfast, sandwiches at lunch, a nice buttered roll at dinner. It's comforting and delicious, and bread is often what we crave, but sometimes it can sit a little heavy after a meal. That's where Hero Bread comes in. They've created fluffy, delicious versions of the breads that we're used to, but that include no net carbs, 0 grams of sugar, and fewer calories. Oh, and there's more good stuff too, like protein and fiber. Hero Bread has everything from your daily sandwich loaf to tortillas or hot dog and hamburger buns. The products are flavorful and they have something for every craving, from a dressed-up breakfast burrito to a late-night PB&J.
They even have monthly small batch drops of indulgent treats like 2 gram net carb hero croissant or the 1 gram net carb hero cheddar biscuit. Don't give up being a breadhead. Hero Bread is offering 10% off your order. Go to hero.co and use code TABLE at checkout. That's TABLE at hero.co. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters. We're talking to Robin Mai, the James Beard Award-winning chef of FET in Honolulu, and we're taking your cooking questions together. Let's get to our first caller. All right, let's go to Claire.
Hi, Francis. This is Claire calling from Saudi Arabia. I was wondering what to do with leftover duck. I have mostly just the bones and skin from a beautiful roast that I made, and I don't want all of its goodness to go to waste, so I would love some suggestions. Thank you for doing what you do. I love the Splendid Table and have been listening to it my whole life. Okay, take care. Bye.
That is so super nice. Well, thank you, Claire. And Chef, what would you do with her leftover roast duck? I love that she has the carcass still, too.
Yes, I have two answers to that. And they're both sort of soup-like. Because she has the carcass, it's nice to just use the whole thing. My first instinct is to make juk. So try to pull off as much of that meat first and set it aside. And then you take the carcass and then you make a stock out of the carcass. Just sort of like leftover turkey, you know, your turkey dinner. We always had juk, which is congee.
Rice porridge.
And then you cook that carcass, and depending where you want to go, you can add some aromatics to it, like onions and celery and carrots. If you wanted to go a different route, you can add some like ginger and garlic. But really, you're making a flavorful stock. You let that go for maybe an hour and a half. It doesn't have to be very long.
Do you boil in the French style in culinary school, as we were taught, it's like, oh, never let it boil. You want it clear.
I kind of
feel like if you boil it, it tastes good.
I think you can boil it. I think that a rolling hard boil is maybe a little bit too much action. But like, we don't have time to just like watch it simmer. So, and you know, we're making congee. We're not making a consomme. So I would also add some salt at this point. And then take that carcass out and then let it cool. And if there's any more bits that we can like, you know, excavate from the carcass, I would do that. and then of course, straining the stock. So now you have the stock and then you can add your rice to it and you just let it cook. The ratio, I feel like, I don't know this off the top of my head. I feel like it's something like 1 to 12 in terms of rice to liquid.
A cup of rice to like 12 cups of stock or whatever.
Yes, but I do know that congee/juk is so forgiving, and you can like continue to add some liquid. And the fun part is the garnishing. So you can do like roasted peanuts and finely shredded lettuce, cilantro, scallions, and then, you know, you can dress it with anything. Soy sauce, sriracha. Yeah. Anything that you
pepper,
have,
white pepper,
oyster sauce, sesame oil, and really, it's, I mean, I grew up eating juk, so I think that's a really easy way to use the whole carcass and the meat. Something very similar that I thought about is laksa, which is a Malaysian coconut curry soup. So you can start the same way, except you're going to introduce some coconut milk in there, and then I would just use one of the curry pastes. Sure, you can use a traditional Malaysian curry paste that you can find at an Asian grocer, but really anything that you have on hand, any color, the yellow one, the green one, the red one, it really doesn't matter. And with the laksa...
So you make the same duck stock.
Yes.
But add a little bit of canned curry paste and coconut milk.
Yes.
Okay. Right
and on. Then, you know, you can add some vegetables, maybe some chunked up carrots and potatoes, maybe some turnip. Laksa, I would add a bit of sugar. So some brown sugar to it to balance out that heat. And then to actually, you know, make the coconut taste more coconutty.
Yeah, sure.
And then you add the duck meat to it.
That sounds super good.
But I love laksa because I just love the brightness of the flavors. You can squeeze some lime at the end and add some cilantro.
And noodles.
And noodles, yes, absolutely.
Yeah, rice noodles, yeah.
And then if you happen to have on hand, I would never say, hey, you need to go out and buy this to make laksa. But if you had some shrimp on hand, you can just throw that in too. And shrimp and duck go really nicely together.
Oh, I love that. What do you do with the skin? Like, would you boil the skin in the stock?
Yeah, I would actually take the skin off, set it aside, okay. And then you can crisp it up in the oven or underneath your broiler and use it as a garnish, sort of like cracklings.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Love that. All right, let's move on to D.
My question is about smoked salmon. I used to work with smoked salmon, but I've forgotten much more than I ever knew about it. So here's my question. I have a frozen salmon in my freezer that my husband caught in Alaska.
Oh, right on.
I would like to take it out, thaw it, and process it for smoking, and I'm not sure exactly how to do that. I need to know how to make a brine. I think it's half brown sugar, half white sugar, and the other half of the brine should be salt. Then I need to know how long I would brine it. Cut it up into smaller pieces, how big. And then I would like to smoke it in a smoke box on my barbecue, but I'm not sure how to time that or how to tell when it is finished. I'm hoping the chef can help me.
Okay, so chef, what would you do if you had a beautiful side of salmon that you wanted to smoke? I guess we don't really know if she wants to hot smoke it or cold smoke it, but...
Yes.
Like cold smoke it, like lox, you'd slice it for bagels, and or hot smoke, you have like this beautiful cooked smoked salmon. But
it does sound like she wants to hot smoke it. And she has a smoker box already. And so that's like half the work is done. If she has a smoker box, okay, I look at smoking fish in three steps. So the first step is to do a brine. And a good ratio is one part sugar to two parts salt.
And then how much? And then how many parts water?
Oh, now I have to do the math, Francis. Hold on.
Yeah.
let's see.
It wasn't a trick question, I swear.
Okay, so if we go 1 pound of kosher salt to half a pound of brown sugar, and then now 8 quarts.
Okay, so 2 gallons of water.
2 gallons of water. That makes a bunch. Because it's the restaurant ratio that we use here because we're making a lot. But anyways.
Yeah. You can have that. It's 1 gallon of water, half a pound of salt, and 1/4 pound of brown sugar.
Oh, my God. See? It's the University of Michigan.
Yeah, I stare at recipes.
Education. Okay. So that's the brine. And you're going to, depending upon how thick your fish fillets are, you're going to... soak the fish in that brine. I would say if your fish is about 1 inch, maybe 2 hours, any thicker, maybe anywhere from 2 to 4 hours in that brine.
Okay, so not super long. Not like over for 3 days or whatever.
Yeah. No.
Okay.
And then what we do, because we don't have a smoke box at the restaurant, we do cheat and add a little bit of liquid smoke. And I don't think that that's a bad thing. I think that liquid smoke gets a bad rap because people use too much.
Sure.
You just need to use a smidge.
Okay.
Okay, so that's step one, the brining. Step two is, now I'm going to throw out a technical term. It's called pellicle. So you want to take the fish out, pat it dry really, really nicely, and then put it on a rack on a sheet pan.
Okay.
So there's airflow. And you want to space the fish out enough where the air can circulate. And you want to let that cruise in your refrigerator until what is called a pellicle forms. And it's just like a thin membrane.
Yeah, like a sort of a tacky skin.
Yes.
Like it dries out enough to be sort of tacky. Yeah.
Yes. And what that does is it allows the smoke to really sort of penetrate into the fish. Like it's like almost like it grabs onto the smoke.
Yeah.
That will take, depending upon the atmosphere of your refrigerator. That would take at least 24 hours.
Okay,
you can feel it. It should feel tacky and sort of like dry at the same time. So that's step two. And then step three is the smoking itself. I like fruit tree wood chips, cherry and apple over hickory. And then you want to make sure that there's like a constant temperature, you know, of the smoking process. At the restaurant, we actually set the oven at 200 degrees. And then we take a sheet pan and we line it with foil. We put the chips on and then we put that directly onto our gas stoves and we blast the stoves until those chips are actually smoking. They turn black. Yeah. So it's actually, you're creating the smoke. We put that into the oven underneath the fish that's still on the rack. If you don't have a smoke box, you kind of have to monitor, you know, what's happening to make sure that there's a continuous amount of smoke. So that's the key. You may have to relight those chips, you know, or like refresh the chips.
If you don't see them smoldering and you don't smell it.
And then sometimes we like, you know, keep the door just ajar just to get some airflow in. So that's what's nice about having a box is that it's designed to have that airflow.
And then how long would you leave it in there for?
It takes anywhere from 2 to 4 hours. And so I imagine...
For like a whole side of salmon?
Yeah. And then what you're looking for too, you are essentially cooking it. You're just cooking it very, very slowly with an abundance of smoke. And so you want to make sure that it's cooked all the way through. You need to check it to make sure it's flaking.
Yeah.
And you don't want to go too long because then you're just going to like make...
Jerky.
It's going to dry out. Jerky. Yes. Yes. But I love this idea. And, you know, and I'm not embarrassed to say this, but smoked fish keeps beautifully in the freezer.
Oh, right on.
Yeah.
Delicious. All right, cool. Let's go to another one. Let's go to Jeff.
Hi, Francis and Robin. I have a question that's a bit controversial. It's about Chili Crisp. I'm new to the Chili Crisp game. I started with Carla Lolly Music's Mustard Chili Sizzle. It's lovely, simple, very few ingredients, and I loved it. So next, I took the leap and tried Sola El Whaley's Chili Crisp recipe that has no fewer than 17 ingredients. All respect in the world to Sola, but I found it almost too complex. And it's a bit cost prohibitive. Ingredients like cardamom pods, Kashmiri chilies, shiitake mushroom powder, and other things that you might not just have laying around in your pantry. Okay. So I need a hot take. Get it? Hot Chili Crisp. Which ingredients must be in a Chili Crisp? What's that base recipe that will set me up for success? Thanks a lot.
Oh, wow,
well,
Jeff.
Thanks, Jeff.
I love this question.
Well, actually, for people who don't know it yet, how would you describe a Chili Crisp?
Well, growing up, a Chili Crisp was a chili oil that had all these flavorful chunks inside. But nowadays I think it's like really, really taken on a new life.
Totally.
Sola's recipe is almost sort of like a snack.
Yeah.
It's so chunky. And she does say she's unapologetic about that. And I don't know Sola personally, but I know her background. She's a chef. She's a restaurant chef. Restaurant chefs, when they start tinkering in the kitchen and making their version of something that they love, they will actually go to the extremes. They want to make the most sort of impactful version out there. And I think that is the spirit of Sola's recipe. I feel like we can do a whole show on Chili Crisp.
Yeah, totally. I think you're totally right, though. Like, when I was growing up, we certainly had chili oils that had, like, little bits of the chili, like, you know, maybe a little bit of garlic. But I think, like, Chili Crisp is, you know, sort of a more modern version. I've seen, you know, ones with, like, seeds and nuts and lots of fried shallots and fried garlic bits. It's a condiment, like you would use chili oil, but it's, like, there's so much crunchiness. And I think people have just taken it and run with it. And I kind of feel, Jeff, I hate to say it. There's so many good brands out there. Like, just go buy one. The Lao Gan Ma is like $4. You know, there's like these artisanal brands are like $15. You know, they can get a wide range in price, but like there's so many you can just buy it. I kind of feel like if you're going to make it, go all out and just make it. Like Sola, I'm with Sola, like 17 ingredients, packet full of like fried shallots, like, you know, do it up.
I think that on the other side of the spectrum, Genevieve Coe has a recipe on the New York Times cooking site, and hers is really, really pared down.
Okay.
Although she's still, you're still cooking, frying
the chilies and frying, yeah.
But she has, and I think this is brilliant, she does have a hack in there. She asked for dried minced onion.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Which I think is brilliant. My inclination, because the restaurant is in Chinatown, I would buy the prefab fried shallots. Have you? Do you know what I'm talking about?
Oh God, I love that.
You know that you can just
eat a big jar of just like crispy fried shallots. Yeah,
but I think that the spirit of chili crisp is you need the oil, obviously. And then you need some sort of fried aromatics. So it could be onions, it could be shallots, it could be the mix. Not all chili crisps have ginger, but sometimes that finds their way in. But I do think there always has to be a sugar component and a salt component. And then,
what do you mean by sugar? Like, do you literally put sugar in it?
Yes. Or? Yes.
Okay.
And again, this is, I think that this is part of what makes chili crisp addicting is people don't realize it is the sugar that is sort of like, you know.
Because it balances, right?
It's yes.
It's sweet, it's spicy, but having that sugar kind of keeps you.
Yes, keep on going back for more.
Yeah.
And then, of course, there's the chili aspect. And so you can go as simple as just using red pepper flakes, or you can go as elaborate and just about use any dried chili that you can get your hands on. You just want to make sure you take out the seeds before you start processing the chilies up into smaller bits. So, and then the last, maybe there are two more components to chili crisp. One is, I think there does need to be a seed aspect or a nut aspect.
Okay.
So sesame seeds.
For the texture.
Yeah. You know, peanuts, cashews, soy nuts. And then some people will probably say there has to be Szechuan peppercorns. I don't know. It's not my favorite. My opinion would you need to use sort of like just the right amount, but some people like that numbing aspect when they make this. So I love this question because there's so many different, there's not a right answer. It's just whatever floats your boat. And really if you're using dried minced onion prefab or dried or fried shallots prefab, the bottom line is that you can still make a terrific addicting condiment either way.
Yeah. And it's funny because like people are like, oh, what do you put it on? And I think that the automatic answer for everyone who's a fan of it is like, oh, literally anything. But I love it, especially with like stir-fried noodles.
Yes.
Or, you know, something like that where you can kind of really, I like that, like mixing it into stuff.
I love it. I love it on eggs.
Eggs, great.
Yeah. Like sunny eggs on rice.
Yeah. Or something really simple, like a very simple cooked piece of chicken, a very simple pork chop or something like that,
yes.
Like a little bit of chili crisp. But yeah, for me, it's fried rice, fried noodles. I always reach for some kind of chili oil condiment. I started doing it with pasta too, actually.
I
there's this great brand called Fly by Jing, and she's actually based in Sichuan. So there's Sichuan peppercorn in that one. And it's probably the least crispy chili crisp I can think of. Like she has like fermented black beans. Like there's more like sort of soft textures in hers. It's not crunchy or crispy really, but very tasty. Super delicious, floral aromatic. And I start putting it on macaroni and cheese. And like now it's like, I can't have macaroni and cheese without Fly by Jing chili crisp.
My mouth is watering. That sounds so good. Like cheesy grits too.
Oh yeah.
I also think that, Jeff, you should come up with your ultimate version and then make a whole bunch for gift giving for the holidays. And people will be so stoked because who needs another box of cookies when you can get chili crisp from someone? Really, I think everyone should make chili crisp.
I love that. And send me a jar. And send Robin a jar.
We'll be back with more of your questions and answers with Chef Robin Mai, and then award-winning cookbook author Nick Sharma joins us to talk about crispy things. I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. Our show is supported by Hero Bread. You know, for a lot of us, bread has been a staple all our lives. Toast at breakfast, sandwiches at lunch, a nice buttered roll at dinner. It's comforting and delicious, and bread is often what we crave. But sometimes, it can sit a little heavy after a meal. That's where Hero Bread comes in. They've created fluffy, delicious versions of the breads that we're used to, but that include no net carbs, 0 grams of sugar, and fewer calories. Oh, and there's more good stuff too, like protein and fiber. Hero Bread has everything from your daily sandwich loaf to tortillas or hot dog and hamburger buns. The products are flavorful and they have something for every craving, from a dressed-up breakfast burrito to a late-night PB&J. They even have monthly small-batch drops of indulgent treats like 2-gram net-carb Hero Croissant or the 1-gram net-carb Hero Cheddar Biscuit. Don't give up being a breadhead. Hero Bread is offering 10% off your order. Go to hero.co and use code TABLE at checkout. That's table at hero.co. I'm Francis Lam, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters. We're with Robin Mai, the James Beard Award-winning chef of Fete in Hawaii, and we're taking your cooking questions today. All right, and now let's go to Roxanne.
Hi, Francis. I am calling with a question regarding oyster mushrooms. I recently found a local grocer that sells produce that is on its way out, but still obviously edible. I got a bunch of oyster mushrooms, and I don't know what to do with them. Every recipe I find online is just sauteed mushrooms, and I didn't know if there was anything better out there. Thanks. Bye.
Well, thanks, Martha. I love that you have a grocer that specializes in, like, older produce that's still good. I imagine it's like a lot less expensive, and like, if you cook it that night or you cook it in the next couple of days, it, you know, that's a great way to do your shopping. Chef, I want to get to you in a second, but I have to tell you, the first way I ever learned to cook oyster mushrooms is still my favorite, which is because they're an unusual shape, but you can kind of like pluck them off like petals, and the petals are all pretty much like bite size. So you like kind of pluck the oyster mushroom apart, so they're all individual petals, and you get your oven going really hot, like 425 or whatever, and salt, olive oil, get them like pretty nicely slicked in the olive oil, lay the petals out on your sheet tray, flat, not all piled up on one another, so they have a little bit of room to breathe, and then you just roast it until the petals dry, and when they dry, they crisp in the oven. You have to watch it so you don't burn them, but if you get to like a medium to like sort of darkish brown, you pull them out and you can eat them like chips. They have all that umami concentrated into like a crunchy, oily, olive oily kind of chip. It's like, it's spectacular. So that's my favorite thing to do with oyster mushrooms. But what would you say?
The exact same. I literally would do the exact same. I think that the important thing to mention is that when tossing the mushrooms with some olive oil or whatever oil you're using, is that you're pretty generous.
Yeah.
We roast a lot of mushrooms at the restaurant, and so our new cooks, when we show them how much oil to use, they're like afraid. They're like, "Oh my goodness, that's so much oil." But the mushroom can handle the oil. I mean, obviously you don't want it swimming, but you really want to be generous with the oil. And like Francis said, you want to make sure that the pieces are spread out so they have some air to like circulate around them. And you don't want them too crowded. Otherwise, the roasting is not going to be the same. But that's what I would do. I would maybe toss some herbs in there as well. Maybe some really, really, really thinly sliced garlic. But yeah, what a great addition to almost anything, you know?
Yeah, and like a big handful of that. I mean, I sit there and just snack on them. You don't have to like cook them all the way to like a chip, but like until they're a little crispy around and maybe still have a little chewiness, and like that's a beautiful, you know, just mushroom side dish or vegetable dish, or from there you can dress it. Like you're saying herbs, like, oh, I think like a salsa verde or a chimichurri.
Yeah.
Sort of lightly dress it would be delicious on the side of anything.
I mean, you can make a beautiful steak dress it with the salsa verde or the chimichurri, and then garnish that with the mushrooms on top. So like instead of having sauteed mushrooms, you can have this beautiful sort of like crunchy, really, really flavorful, umami-packed garnish. Also really terrific in a salad, because I'm always looking for ways to sort of pack in umami in a salad, because I think people would eat more salad.
Let's all eat more salad.
Yes. Or I have another idea. So you can make, the ubiquitous green bean casserole, and instead of like the fried onions on top, you can put this like nice roasted,
big old
oysters.
Like,
mushrooms
on top.
Yeah.
Oh, I love that. That actually sounds great. Like green beans would sound really good with that, because they have that like sort of earthy sweetness, and you have like the umami and crispiness. I love that. Well, Chef, this has been so great. It's been so great to see you again. And thanks so much for coming by.
Thank you, Francis. Love seeing you.
Robin Mai'i is the chef owner of Fett in downtown Honolulu, Hawaii, and she left us with a recipe for simple smoked fish for the home oven. You'll find it at splendidtable.org. You know, when we were talking about Chili Crisp with Chef Robin, it occurred to me that, while it might be a good long time before I will go and fry a bunch of shallots and garlic chips to make a hot sauce out of them, I do love having those things on hand to just make stuff taste better. A plate of noodles or pasta or a grain bowl, fried rice, salad, a plate of roasted vegetables, there really isn't hardly anything that isn't improved with a handful of fried shallots, fried garlic, or really anything crispy or crunchy. So Nick Sharma is a terrific food writer and cookbook author, and whose previous career was as a scientist. And that keeps him curious about how food works and how to make it better. And his books, Season and Flavor Equation, are so smart and so beautiful. And I thought of them right away when we were thinking about crispy things that you can make as a cheat code for any meal. Hey, Nick, it's great to see you.
Likewise, Francis.
So you are always so thoughtful about how flavor works, but do you actually know why, like, one of the universal things that everyone loves is a crispy or crunchy texture?
Oh, absolutely. If you think about food, think about it like this, and I'm going to sound like the Golden Girls when they tell you, like, imagine Sicily. I'm going to tell you instead, imagine yourself floating in the ocean with no waves, no sea life. It's flat. It's boring. That's exactly what happens in the mouth when if you're eating, for example, yogurt. Imagine if it's just flat, smooth, and creamy. That's nice initially, but after a while, your mouth will experience what's called fatigue, textural fatigue. Mm. And that then tells the brain that, okay, this is boring. Like, it needs something else. And that's when textures come into play. We add different types of foods together with different textures, soft, crunchy, because it builds textural interest in the brain. And then that makes us appreciate food better because it tastes better. It's more delicious.
Oh, that's so interesting. I mean, it's something we kind of all just feel innately, but it's interesting to know that the brain actually is like talking to itself in a way about it. And, in your book, you have a nice list of like things you can add to a dish or things you can, elements that you would add for texture. And you have soft and tender and creamy, but the list for crunchy and crispy is like twice the size of everything else. So I wanted to get you to talk about some of those things that you like to have on hand just to give that contrasting texture. And I love crispy shallots. I usually fry them in oil, but you have a cool oven technique for them. Can you tell me how you make crispy shallots?
Oh, yeah. So I'm all about being lazy in the kitchen. I like low effort recipes that pay off really well, because I really, especially with onions and shallots, I do not want to sit in front of them sobbing my way through, stirring them on the stove. So what I do is thinly slice the shallots or onion. The thinner they are, the faster they'll cook. So, they'll crisp up faster. And then what I do is I toss them with very little olive oil and a tiny pinch of salt and a little splash of vinegar. And just swirl them around directly on the baking sheet, put them in a single flat layer, stick them in an oven at 300 degrees Fahrenheit, and then watch them till they get brown and crispy. And what I do is occasionally after the first 15 minutes, I'll go in and you know, just kind of give them a good swirl and move them all around so they evenly brown on the baking sheet. So this method I find produces better, crispier shallots or onions because the surface area is just wide. So the rate of evaporation is better. Okay. If I used a saucepan, which I used to use before when I learned how to make them, it always ends up becoming jammy because it's so difficult to control the rate of evaporation. So all that water that's coming from the onions or the shallots starts to condense and fall back into the pan. And so then you end up getting onion jam. On a baking sheet in the oven, that is a foolproof method.
What does the vinegar do? Wouldn't it keep them soft?
Yeah, so vinegar is simply acetic acid, and it's quite harsh on a lot of vegetables and meats because most animals and plants, except for bacteria and yeast, don't synthesize vinegar. And so when it comes into contact with these tissues, it actually breaks them down really well. So in this case, we're not actually adding a lot. It's like a couple of drops of vinegar. Then what that does is that it brings out the flavor of the onions. It makes them taste better. And if you're using red onions or red shallots that are, you know, the color becomes even bolder because they get their color from a pigment called anthocyanin. And that turns bright pink at an acidic pH. And so you get this lovely visual brightness as well as they cook.
Oh, cool. And it breaks it down to sort of release a little more of the flavor. That's so interesting.
Yeah.
And when you say one layer, do you mean literally one layer? Like there is one piece of onion on the pan and air above it? Or do you just mean like flat?
Oh, I'm not that stringent on it. Okay. What I mean is that you just lay them out in a fine, thin layer. So it's just even. So they all cook at the same rate, hopefully. And in most ovens anyway, that really doesn't happen. Nothing cooks because your corners of the oven are usually hotter than the, you know, the center of the oven. So it's I move them around a little bit, redistribute them again. So you get good, even browning.
And what comes out? Does it come out like super crispy, like crackly, crunchy crispy?
Oh, yeah, it does. So with the onions and shallots, what I've noticed is that they turn crispier. You're using less oil because if you're using a saucepan, sometimes I find myself adding more and more oil to prevent them from burning to the bottom of the saucepan.
Yeah.
But if you're using the oven, they crisp much better because the hot air just does a much better job, especially if you turn on the convection setting of your oven, they'll cook even faster. You just have to watch and make sure they don't burn.
Yeah. How do you keep them from getting soggy, like after you store them? When they're done, you let them cool, and then if you're storing them, do they stay crisp?
So that's a really important thing to do that you just mentioned. Let them cool completely before you first put them in any kind of storage container, be it a zip top bag or a glass container or plastic container, because if you put them hot in there, that's the first thing that happens. You have condensation from the moisture coming out from the vegetables, and then, you know, it makes everything soft. Another thing that I do is I tend to save, because I'm a pack rat, I tend to save those little silica gel bead bags that come with dried seaweed and, you know, those food packages. I save those and reuse them a lot. And it's chemically inert, it's safe for us, which is why they come packaged in food. And I save those bags and then put them with the onions in a... the same container, and that absorbs most of the moisture. Another thing you could do is you could freeze them.
Oh, cool. Okay, great. And what do you like to put them on?
Oh, so if I'm having a poke bowl, if I'm, you know, it's just so nice to have those crunchy shallots on top. If I'm doing, even for breakfast sometimes, I'll just, I'm not a big breakfast person by nature. I get through the day just eating two hard-boiled eggs in the morning, but sometimes I need something more to go along with it. So I'll add blue cheese, kimchi, and crispy shallots. If I'm making a salad, sometimes I'll throw crispy shallots in there. And if I'm making a dal, that's a really another great place to just throw in some crispy shallots on top. It just makes it so much more exciting. And then, of course, with the crispy shallot, you can season them also any way you want once they're done cooking. You can do salt and pepper. You could also add togarashi, whatever you want, za'atar, you know, anything.
Spice mixes.
Yeah. And so you could make it much more personalized to what you like.
Yeah, I love that. Let's move to another thing that you like to do, fried lentils.
Yeah, so fried lentils are a common snack in India, and I think in parts, other parts of South Asia too. And I get the mung beans that are skinned or whole, and I soak them in water, pat them dry, and then partially cook them where they're not falling apart. I just want them to hold their texture, but they're cooked still. And then what I do is, again, I pat them dry.
And you boil it in water, you mean?
Yeah, you want them to be cooked all the way, and then, but you just don't want them to be mushy. You want them to retain the structure. And then what I do is pat them dry, and then I fry them in hot oil in a couple of batches, drain the oil out, and then season them while they're hot with salt and store those. Now, fried lentils are a common snack, like I said, in Indian cooking. But I also find that if I'm making a salad, say if I don't have shallots on hand, I'm craving something crunchy, you know, I can toss that in there. I've done this with scallops. So what I do, it's a weird combination, but it works well. You take scallops, you sear them anyhow you want, put them on a plate, and then put some lime juice on top with these crispy fried lentils. And it tastes so good because you've got that combination of crunchy, the soft, creamy texture of the scallop. It's so good.
Oh, that sounds great. I love lentils. And to me, they have almost like a little bit more of a nutty flavor than a beany flavor, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely.
Do they keep that flavor when they're fried, or is it a different kind of flavor?
So I think the nuttiness becomes much more pronounced and much more fragrant. And honestly, anything fried always tastes better. So in that, I think it just improves lentils. And even like, you know, a person who doesn't eat lentils will get converted at some point.
Let's go to one more. So we talked about the oven, we talked about the fryer, and now here comes the somewhat controversial, but often beloved air fryer, which is sort of basically a convection oven. You have fried jalapenos that you do in an air fryer. Mm. Tell me about those.
So what I do is I cut the jalapenos up, usually into just slices. And I don't de-stem them. I keep the seeds on. And then what I do is I toss them in a little bit of salt just to get some of the water out through osmosis. And then I rinse quickly with cold running tap water and pat them dry. And then I put them in buttermilk and season the buttermilk with a little bit of semolina or all-purpose flour. And then stick them into the convection oven and then cook them. And add a few tablespoons of oil to the semolina, because with an air fryer, you still need oil. You're just using less. Otherwise, it'll taste too bitter. And put that in the air fryer and then let it sit there until it turns golden brown and crispy. And then that's a really great way, again, of having some like a crunchy add-on for your food in the pantry.
Oh, cool. Wait, so you, after you've sliced and salted and rinsed the jalapenos, you put them in buttermilk, and then do you scoop them out of buttermilk?
With and a fork, yeah. With I just pick them up. You don't want
too
much liquid.
You're basically like breading them. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. And then I moved. You can also use Japanese breadcrumbs, the panko breadcrumbs. Those work really well. Those are actually probably one of the crunchiest textures you'll find on that. But and again, that's something that you can also season the way you want to individualize it or personalize it rather for your taste. You can use a bunch of different seasonings, and it's just such a nice thing to have at home.
That's cool. I can imagine that. It's crispy, it's a little bit spicy, and just throw that on top of something.
It's yeah.
Well, thanks so much, Nick. These are great ideas, and I really can't wait to go fry some lentils.
Yeah, let me know how that works out for you.
Nick Sharma is the award-winning author of Season and The Flavor Equation. You can find his recipe for chicken congee topped with crispy shallots at splendidtable.org. And that is our show for the week. Thank you for listening, and go cook something great, will you? We'll talk to you next week. APM Studios are run by Chandra Kavati and Joanne Griffith. Beth Perlman's our executive producer, and The Splendid Table was created by Lynn Rosetto Casper and Sally Swift. It's made every week by technical producer Jennifer Lupke, producer Erica Romero, digital producer James Napoli, and managing producer Sally Swift. Subscribe to our podcast on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you get your downloads. Be sure to leave us a review. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.